Production made possible in part by MedPlus Advantage.
You're listening to Radio Rounds, a talk show created and hosted by physicians in training, where today's stories are told by tomorrow's doctors. I'm Shami Das, a third-year emergency medicine resident at Emory in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm also one of the directors and co-founders of the show. And today, I have the pleasure of sharing this special episode featuring one of the brightest ER docs in the country, Dr. Stephen Pitts. Dr. Pitts serves as associate professor at both the Emory University School of Medicine and the Rollins School of Public Health, with experience in both the community and academic emergency medicine. Earlier this year, Dr. Pitts published a study in JAMA's Medical Education issue describing the differences between resource utilization in community and academic emergency departments. He investigated the long-held belief that medical education utilizes more resources in these large academic hospitals than in community practice settings.
Sat down again with the data, redid it on the more current iterations of data, and found the same result, essentially, that there was indeed more use of resources. And we limited ourselves to four different things, namely advanced imaging, hospital admission, blood testing, and length of stay, rather than trying to work out a dollar amount, because dollar amounts depend a lot on your environment and mm-hmm. geographic variation and stuff. So we found essentially all but one of those resources were used more frequently in teaching encounters. But the added twist was that we looked at the data aggregated by ER, mm-hmm. assuming that the type of ER may have an impact on that.
Stay tuned to hear our discussion about how the training environment has changed over the past three decades and what future challenges lay ahead. Welcome back to Radio Rounds, everyone. My name is Shami Das, and I'm especially honored to share my interview with Emory attending and academic Dr. Stephen Pitts. His research interests have included national acute care policy with a special focus on emergency department operations, observation medicine, infectious diseases, and hypertension. And earlier this year, he published a study with then-chief resident Dr. Justin Schrager in JAMA's Medical Education issue describing differences between resource utilization in community and academic emergency departments. They question the long-held belief that medical education utilizes more resources than in private community settings. In this time of graduate medical education reform, their findings have implications in light of the controversial IOM report, Institute of Medicine report, calling for drastic reform of the graduate medical education financing system. Now join us for a thought-provoking and informative discussion. All right, Dr. Pitts, thank you for joining us today on Radio Rounds. It's a pleasure to have you on the show finally.
I thank you for the opportunity.
Now, in the introduction, we heard about your recent publication in JAMA, but before we get to that, I'd like to talk a little bit about how you got to that point. Specifically, tell us how you got interested in the areas of emergency department utilization and access to care.
Well, I started off as a practicing doctor. Most of my career was working, like most practicing ER docs, working shifts and seeing lots of patients. Kind of, in my case, started off by default getting into emergency medicine because I was actually trained as an internist back in 80 to 83. And in those days, there was no real emergency medicine presence. Mm-hmm. And so I grandfathered in. Actually, like many, I thought I was going to do a fellowship in one of the medicine specialties. As things worked out, it didn't work out that way. And I'm happy with my choice. It turned out that emergency medicine was a growth field, and lots of interesting things happened along the way.
So as I understand, you took your emergency medicine boards nearly 10 years after starting internal medicine. What led to that change in specialty?
Yeah, so I initially thought I would tread water and just see patients make money working shifts because it was convenient and actually somebody needed my help. At a time when I was waiting for my wife to finish residency. During that period, I became interested in the sort of concept of seeing patients at their sickest and their least differentiated, and also developed a sort of hobby of numbers in medicine and epidemiology, and Atlanta was a big epidemiology town. So it turned out that for me it was a pretty good career move. After 10 years, I realized I was never going to do an internal medicine subspecialty. and decided to go ahead and do the boards. It was still possible. I was about the last generation, or probably the last year, where you could still get boarded in emergency medicine with just an internal medicine residency.
And so as you explained, so that was a very up-and-coming time for emergency medicine. What was it like to practice when you started compared to how it's practiced today?
A whole lot looser. Much less corporatization of care at the time. The sort of joke and tradition is that in those days, emergency departments were run by kind of medical failures, people who had were you know, either alcoholics or couldn't speak English, or were sort of semi-retired, or perhaps starting a practice in some other specialty and needing to stay alive and feeding themselves by working shifts. It was a fee-for-service era where you might charge, you know, a dollar per stitch. It was very, very different from what it is today. There was a lot of, you know, dumping was universal. If somebody was extra sick, you would try to put them, send them over to Grady, the main county hospital downtown. A very different environment.
Could you tell us a little bit about what it was like to train at Grady?
Yeah, so I trained at Grady. My initial emergency medicine practice was actually at a little private hospital that ultimately became an academic hospital. But I went back to Grady after doing the private ER stuff for a few years with some trepidation, because the ER at Grady was really chaotic. I mean, you may think of your ER as chaotic, but in those days we had things like your triple parked stretchers. If someone had a cardiac arrest against the wall, you had to step over two other people to do CPR. Not enough light in the hallways to start an IV. And IVs were, of course, started by the residents, not by nurses. We had a lot of practices that no longer exist, but that were quite labor-intensive. For example, giving IV aminophylline to asthmatics almost invariably too fast, and consequently with a lot of nausea and vomiting. Horrendously poorly managed sickle cell anemia. Just a lot of and you had to – it would have been interesting, I think, for you to see what we used for central lines back in those days. They were through-the-needle catheters, gigantic large-bore needles through which you threaded the plastic catheter.
Through the catheter, through the needle.
Through the needle.
Instead of the other way around,
and there was this,
over the wire.
There was this fear, and it happened periodically, of accidentally backing up the plastic catheter and shearing it off with the needle.
Oh, my gosh.
With a subsequent catheter embolus.
Yeah.
So – it's really hard to get across the differences between now and then. It was the residency in those days was run by people no more advanced than third year. There was essentially no adult presence, and it was pretty juvenile kind of environment, if you must know the truth.
Well, and to be honest, that's how it was across the country, right? Oh, so, you know, at large county hospitals throughout the United States, this was the environment.
Absolutely. I mean, it was not just Grady. Grady was kind of a startling example of that because it was such a huge county facility. But throughout my residency, I never saw anybody over 40 except for that 2 hours of Monday, Wednesday, Friday rounds in internal medicine. Everything else was run by residents. Even the major traumas were run by third years.
Wow. So, you know, in many ways, it still remains a resident-driven program, but needless to say, there's far much more adult supervision.
A lot more. And, I mean, there are actually pros and cons to that. I could talk about some of the time, possibly.
Well, let's talk about that. So I think, you know, one of the things I wanted to discuss with you later on was, you know, in terms of the findings of your paper, maybe we can just dive into it now, but, you know, is there a difference between degree of supervision and resource utilization?
Yeah, I think there probably is. Well, I mean, it was you had huge amounts of patient volume back then, but far less demand in terms of documentation. So I remember one particular night where usually there were two interns and a resident running the entire medical emergency clinic. And the resident developed the flu. He was really sick. He said he was going to the back and going to sleep. So between me and another intern, we saw 60 patients. And I had a little bit of an epiphany after that shift, which was that this was really, really not right, that the citizens of Atlanta had abandoned their sickest patients to the least trained and the least powerful of all their practitioners, and sort of made this a statement to myself privately that this couldn't go on and I would have to help make it better. We were fortunate that we didn't have this massive documentation burden that you guys have now, But nevertheless, it was quite nerve-wracking and sort of a little bit of terror involved, because these were pretty sick people. They were not unsick folks.
Sure. You know, a lot of your research touches on, and we'll get to this later, but the distinction between large teaching hospitals and smaller community hospitals, for example. Tell us what the findings of were your paper and, you know, maybe how the inception of the project in general came to be.
It actually started as an idea a good long time ago. Todd Berger was was one of the educators who ultimately became the residency director in Austin at their new program. But I was just getting I was discovering how to do analysis of the national ER data set, which involved a little bit of additional skill beyond the usual creating tables. And I noticed that they had a checkbox for whether or not this was a teaching encounter. And so Todd and I sat down and said, well, let's compare the teaching encounters to the non-teaching encounters. We actually found that there was a significant more usage of resources among the teaching encounters. Kind of dropped the project. Todd went on to left town. But more recently, with the advent of some new faculty, I thought it would be fun to revisit this and look at it a little more carefully now that I had a better understanding of the data set. And then a good venue for potential publication would have been the educational issue of JAMA. Mm-hmm. So sat down again with the data, redid it on the more current iterations of data, and found the same result, essentially, that there was indeed more use of resources. And we limited ourselves to four different things, namely advanced imaging, hospital admission, blood testing, and length of stay, rather than trying to work out a dollar amount, because dollar amounts depend a lot on your environment and mm-hmm. geographic variation and stuff. So we found essentially all but one of those resources were used more frequently in teaching encounters. But the added twist was that we looked at the data aggregated by ER, mm-hmm. assuming that the type of ER may have an impact on that. And, you know, the logic behind that is that we know that ERs are different. I mean, my shift at the county hospital is very different from a shift at the teaching hospital or even the community hospital that, mm-hmm. that are part of our system. So we plugged in the additional information of ED level analysis and were able to segregate the sample EDs by what proportion of visits were seen by residents. And, of course, there were some EDs, a small number, but there were some EDs that had more than half of visits seen by residents. And those were what we called major teaching hospitals. Mm-hmm. And then there were minor teaching hospitals, but the majority of hospitals were non-teaching hospitals. So we had three different hospital types we could identify, and that actually turned out to have a significant impact on whether or not on how much resources were used by teaching encounters.
But when you're looking at the tests and the imaging ordered and comparing residents to attending-only cases, there doesn't seem to be as big of a difference in the large teaching hospitals.
It's been a traditional assumption that teaching does account for more resources, and therefore teaching encounters need to have this indirect medical education funding that it's always had. But I think it's much more nuanced than that. In fact, it could very well be that the reason for the increased resource use in minor teaching hospitals is, which are driving the entire relationship, mm-hmm. It could be that that is due to residual confounding, that there's other things that identify extra sick people besides what we had available to us. We had age. We had what we would consider likely to be potent mm-hmm. Covariates, including age, insurance type, and most other sociodemographic characteristics, and found that the teaching effect remained even when you accounted for those things. So, however, there may be things we did not adjust for. I mean, you know from your experience that certain kinds of patients are going to be more complicated, even if they are not. It's hard to define why.
Right.
For example, nursing home patients, we didn't account for that. Probably too small of a proportion to use in our mm-hmm. equations. But yes, what we did find is that among the major teaching hospitals, there was no difference in the admission rate and the advanced imaging rate compared with non-teaching encounters. The one big difference that remained, even when you accounted for the degree of teaching involvement, was length of stay. Mm-hmm. In other words, the hospitals like Grady, the big teaching hospitals, the major teaching hospitals, had very long length of stay. And, you know, you can't ignore the fact that we all know, which is that the major teaching hospitals tend to be public hospitals.
Sure.
And they're under-resourced in a big way. And that, and furthermore, they're managed greatly by the residents themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, the residents are responsible for turnaround times.
Right.
In minor teaching hospitals, the residents often are little add-ons to the regular flow. And whereas where the residents are actually responsible for turnaround times, they are managed them more effectively. That's the view, that's the way I view this. Mm. But they have to. I mean, in order to keep the waiting room from exploding, you have to do less stuff. You have to try to be more efficient.
You also note in the paper that there's possibly some element of cherry-picking going on in the minor teaching hospitals, right, where some of the more straightforward cases are just seen by attendings, and the more complicated patients are seen, or more interesting patients are seen by residents and attendings.
Absolutely, yeah. It's the cherry picking. The whole concept with adjusting statistically was to try to eliminate the cherry picking. But the point is, it's maybe very difficult to do that. And that's pretty much a standard problem with observational research like this. This is a cross-sectional sample. Mm-hmm. It's hard to determine causality, but it's quite likely that there was some, I mean, there certainly was cherry picking, but the effect of that, we don't know for certain right. whether we completely eliminated that effect by adjusting statistically.
Now, by demonstrating that in certain settings, residents do utilize more resources, so, you know, again, confirming what we've already suspected for a long time, and the nuance that in larger teaching hospitals, they don't necessarily order more tests and imaging than their attending counterparts. What are the implications for GME funding and the whole implication of, you know, hospitals getting paid money for teaching residents?
Yeah, that's a great question, Shami, and that's something I hope you'll think about because it's beyond me. So yeah, that's a huge policy issue right now. It's a big issue right now because in last July there was a huge controversial Institute of Medicine report on mm-hmm. GME that will probably affect, it could potentially affect residency training in a big way. The main point of the IOM committee was to make education more sensitive to the needs of the community, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's a democracy. The government shouldn't be paying for something unless it affects the health of the nation. And right now we all know that there's massive skewing of distribution of physicians into specialties, et cetera. There's an undersupply of primary care docs. There's a terrific amount of controversy about how many total docs there should be. Mm-hmm. It's really well known that the IME, the indirect medical education mm-hmm. funding, is basically going into the general ledger of the hospitals, and it disappears. And in fact, as many people have said, it really isn't an educational fund at all. So the point of the IOM was to make education more responsive to the needs of the community. How it will do that is not clear. I mean, the IME funding will more or less disappear. There are going to be two different tracks of funding, one of which will be kind of, the way I understand it, will be given to those higher performers. How that performance will be determined, I'm not sure.
Right.
But my view is our data suggests that the major teaching hospitals probably do a better job of teaching cost consciousness. All residency programs, the average number of hospitals or that emergency medicine training programs use is about 3 to 4. Mm-hmm. So almost all residents are exposed to private sector hospitals and that kind of care, typically where they're seeing a minority of patients. Mm-hmm. And the question is, which lesson will they take home with them? And I would think Our data suggests that major teaching hospitals probably teach a more cost-conscious way of taking care of patients. It's possible that we're not doing a good job at places like Grady in teaching efficiency, teaching patient turnaround. But it's also quite possible, in fact likely, that the reason for the length of stay disparity is lack of resources, long queues.
Right. Well, and the other question I had when reading your paper was determining whether patients that show up at these large academic teaching centers or the major teaching EDs are actually sicker. I mean, is that possible that they're across the board, they're sicker, and therefore we're just ordering more tests anyway.
No, that's actually, I mean, I think that was one of the more interesting findings in our paper, not discussed ever before, as far as I know, is that in major teaching hospitals, patients are sicker based on triage category. Triage category is a problematic variable. It's probably better than any other variable, though. And it's quite clear from our data, and it's, if you look at the correct tables, you'll see that this is true, that in major teaching hospitals, the triage category was markedly more acute. I mean, another thing that's also not really been looked at empirically, although we kind of know this intuitively, and that we found to be the case, is that major teaching hospitals with over half of patients seen by residents are on average way bigger than non-teaching hospitals. On average, 60,000 annual volume. Average, 60,000 annual volume compared with an average of 20,000.
Right.
And it's quite possible, in fact likely, that volume itself, ED visit volume itself, degrades performance.
Sure, there's going to be a point at which the volume exceeds a certain threshold and it just slows everything else down. And
It may be on its own, if we had been able to account for that, the ED level, we weren't able to because of the data were not available on the ED level. But if we had we been able to account for ED volume, that might have actually accounted for quite a bit of this length of stay disparity. I think if there's a one-sentence take-home message from the paper, it's that the teachers of emergency medicine need to include teaching efficient care among their principles, and not just exhaustive care, but efficient care.
I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much for your time today.
Great, thanks.
You're listening to Radio Rounds, and I'm director and co-founder Shami Das. That was my interview with Dr. Stephen Pitts, emergency medicine attending and academic at the Emory University School of Medicine and co-author of a recent JAMA MedEd publication entitled Emergency Department Resource Use by Supervised Residents versus Attending Physicians Alone. You can find links to both Dr. Pitt's article and the IOM report on our website at radiorounds.org. Hearing the stories of seasoned physicians never ceases to amaze and inspire me, especially when they share the very moments that have profoundly shaped their development. While Grady has come a long way from the time when Dr. Pitts practiced, its mission to serve the underserved remains. We see nearly 400 residents of Atlanta each day, and I can attest that our patients are sick, with a capital S. The saying goes, Atlanta can't live without Grady, and that's true now more than ever. As Dr. Pitts and I discussed, the implications are far-reaching for their research and also the future of medicine in terms of graduate medical education. While most of the medical education right now is split between two paths, which is direct and then indirect medical education funding, part of it goes towards our salaries and the other part of it goes towards the hospitals to subsidize the amount of resources that we utilize and productivity perhaps that is lost during the process of training residents. This research suggests that that may not be the case. And I wonder what your thoughts are. Feel free to chime in on our Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter at Radio Rounds. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the process of GME funding and what the future might hold. Thanks again for joining us this week. Stay tuned for more great episodes this season. In the meantime, remember that you can download podcasts of all past episodes. Just search the iTunes store for Radio Rounds, or visit radiorounds.org. If you liked what you heard, contact our team via email, like us on Facebook, and tweet us on Twitter at Radio Rounds. All of that information on our website, radiorounds.org.
Production made possible in part by MedPlus Advantage, sponsored by the American Medical Association, providing group disability and life insurance to students and residents through participating educational institutions. Visit us at medplusadvantage.com.
AMA Insurance is pleased to introduce an individual disability insurance plan called Essentials for MedPlus Advantage participants. Through this plan, eligible graduating medical students have a special one-time opportunity to apply for high-quality individual disability insurance with no intrusive or time-consuming medical exams, only a few basic questions, and with discounted premiums. Apply now as the enrollment period ends soon.
Of course, remember that the views and opinions expressed on Radio Rounds are not representative of the views and opinions of our partners at Radio Rounds. Thanks so much for joining us today, everyone. Have a great week. For the entire staff here at Radio Rounds, I'm Shami Das, and one day, I'll be your doctor.